Today at Reader's Corner, James Barrett, author of Our Final Invention, Artificial Intelligence and the End of the Human Era. I'm Bob Custer. Welcome to Reader's Corner. Until now, human intelligence has had no rival. But as artificial intelligence continues to advance, we should ask ourselves, can we coexist with computers whose intelligence dwarfs our own? In his book, Our Final Invention, Artificial Intelligence and the End of the Human Era, James Barrett peers into the future to explore the perils of developing superintelligent machines. And he extends a heartfelt invitation to join what he calls the most important conversation humanity can have. Today we're featuring an encore edition of our interview with James Barrett. He is a documentary filmmaker who's written and produced films for National Geographic, the Discovery Channel, PBS, and many other broadcasters in the United States and Europe. He joins us by phone for this interview. James Barrett, welcome to Reader's Corner.
Thank you very much, Bob. It's great to be here.
Well, James, a few years ago, I had the opportunity to interview Christopher Steiner. He had written a book called Automate This, How Algorithms Came to Rule Our World. And it was pretty much a rosy scenario, just giving us some insight into how our lives are governed on a daily basis by algorithms cooked up by computer scientists and used by large companies and governments, etc., in governing and regulating our lives. Your book ramps that discussion up significantly. If you had a subtitle like his, it would be How Algorithms or How into Artificial Intelligence Came to Wipe Out the World or Has the Potential of Doing So. But maybe we could start with your helping our listeners understand where artificial intelligence is today. And then, of course, we'll morph into a conversation of where it is headed and the dangers and pitfalls therein.
Sure. Well, first, I'd like to say that despite the title of my book, I'm a giant fan of artificial intelligence. It's out of concern for its development of this incredibly promising technology that I wrote the book. AI is the most profoundly inward-looking science we've ever created. It involves psychology and mathematics and logic and programming and navigation and perception. We're trying to understand how we perceive things, how we see things and hear things. How do we turn that into language? It's a very broad and fascinating science because it really, in a fundamental way, asks us who we are and what we're able to do, and then tries to emulate that in machines. Right now, we're in a real renaissance of AI. It's a very exciting period. IBM's Watson is a great example of a very advanced cognitive architecture. IBM's Watson, by the way, is the machine that defeated Jeopardy champions.
Right.
Right now, IBM's Watson is studying to take the federal medical licensing exam. It's doing legal discovery, which is what first-year law associates do. It's doing business analytics with raw data that we pay people $300 an hour to do. So the good news is the technology is really powerful. The bad news is that's going to cost us a lot of jobs, and AI is going to cost us a lot of jobs, AI and automation, from here out. So where we are right now is this really, really good technology has two faces. One is it promises to free us from a lot of mundane tasks and even do, you know, some sciences better than we can. For example, IBM's Watson can look at an X-ray of lungs and find cancerous areas better than humans can right now. So we're going to benefit from AI, but then at the same time, we're going to suffer in a number of ways. There's job loss. MIT estimates that 50% of all jobs will be automated within 20 years. You know, there are 4 million drivers whose jobs are going to be replaced. These are truck drivers, delivery people, taxi drivers, whose jobs will be replaced within 5 to 10 years. There's 7 million people who do business data input and back office operations, and their jobs are going to go away. So we're going to see tremendous dislocation. What's also concerning in the short term is that there's an intelligence race going on with weapons. We're developing right now, with our tax dollars, autonomous battlefield robots and drones. And these are battlefield robots and drones that kill people without a human in the loop. Now, right now, we've got machines that kill people with humans on the loop, meaning they're monitoring several different drones at the same time, and then they're assigning one to make an assassination. Humans are on the loop in that case, but we'll be out of the loop in the next generation of these devices. And to say nothing of battlefield robots, which are coming up fast. The point of my book, Our Final Invention, is to try to get people to understand something that a lot of people are really catching on to right now, and that's that artificial intelligence is a dual-use technology, like nuclear fission. Nuclear fission can power a city or it can burn up a city. AI is the same way. It can be used for really good purposes and really, really bad ones.
Well, we're going to talk in a minute about machine learning, and you can help us understand artificial general intelligence, which is what you're really worried about. But even before we get there, you mention in your book the National Institute of Standards and Technology that I believe has documented the bad programming cost. First of all, bad programming and the cost of bad programming. And that's something that I don't think those of us who use technology oftentimes think about, in many cases, because we don't know how much of it is out there.
Right. Well, we're developing machines very rapidly that are better programmers than we are. One of the reasons is that each year, bad programming costs our government hundreds of billions of dollars, and that's just in the United States. So there's a giant economic push to create machines that program better than we do. Now, that has a couple of implications beyond making programmers unemployed. It means that in the not-too-distant future, you know, we've got machines right now that are better than we are at chess, at Jeopardy. They're going to be better lawyers. They'll be better diagnosticians. They'll be better business analysts. In the not-too-distant future, they'll be better at artificial intelligence development and research. And once machines are doing artificial intelligence development and research, which is a species of programming, once they're doing that, they'll be able to improve their own intelligence faster than we can improve their intelligence. So they'll be establishing the rate of progress, not humans. Mm-hmm. So a natural progression for this problem we have with programming, that we create a lot of faulty programming, the natural economic progression is that we focus money on improving this programming. Machines program, which they do now, and then the machines get better and better at programming until they're really the main programmers.
Here at Boise State, like many other universities and colleges across the country, we have a College of Engineering, and we're in the business of training and educating the next generation of computer scientists. We have an undergraduate degree, we have a master's degree, and we'll soon have a PhD in computer science engineering. Is there anything that universities and colleges of engineering and computer science departments should be thinking about in terms of training this next generation? What's missing now? And I would add to that, what role is there for the humanist in this conversation? You mentioned this is a science. Artificial intelligence is a science. But the challenges it presents, it seems to me, really begs for input from the humanist community.
Yeah, you know, to answer those questions in order, first of all, there's an enormous role that universities can play, an enormous, enormous role, especially technical universities. And what that is they can introduce ethics into the development of intelligent machines. You know, right now, there are a lot of companies working hard on creating intelligent machines. Google is on the fast track for creating a smart machine with their company that they bought, DeepMind. Ray Kurzweil, who's a giant proponent of AI, is the chief engineer at Google. And listen to this. This is really, it's exciting and frightening to me at the same time. He wants to create a machine that makes 300 trillion calculations per second and to share that with a billion people online. So 300 trillion calculations per second shared with a billion people online. What is that? That's a brain, a question and answer brain, or a factoring brain that can be put online as a resource. So we can all use this virtual brain to solve problems. So they have in their sights creating human-level intelligence in a machine. IBM, with Watson, is really right now the leader in creating cognitive architecture. So there's this real intelligence race going on. But what these companies are doing is rapid product development, not basic research into the nature of intelligence, and not research into ethics as applied to the development of sensitive technology like AI. So colleges and universities can bring to engineers some consideration about stewardship of sensitive technologies. You know, we're encouraged in our culture to innovate, to jump ahead, to set the bar higher. We're not encouraged to think about how to take care of technologies. Our stewardship races way behind our innovation. Our innovation races way ahead of our stewardship, and that's what colleges and universities can start doing, is helping engineers think in ethical dimensions. And that's where humanists come in. The role for humanists is also pretty profound, because as we move into the future and we see our everything around us become cognitized, you know, we're going to have smart homes soon where your home knows a lot about you and it shares that information with a lot of vendors, but it also looks after you. It's going to adjust the temperature. It's going to be able to prepare meals. It's going to be able to clean up. It's going to be able to anticipate your needs. We'll have smart cars that drive themselves. We'll be surrounded by artificial intelligence. It will be ubiquitous. It will be everywhere. There will be things that we do as people that we offload to AI. I know I don't go anywhere without asking Siri for navigation. I do a lot of things with AI every day, as I'm sure you do. But what we have to ask ourselves, and the role for humanists from here out, is what is it about ourselves we want to preserve? Where do we want to draw the line? I'm not going to let every aspect of my life be automated and offloaded. There are things about myself and about ourselves as a culture that I want to preserve. So I think it's up to humanists to say, where are we going to build a bit of a firewall between us and technological encroachment?
You're listening to Reader's Corner. Our guest today is documentary filmmaker James Barrett, author of Our Final Invention, Artificial Intelligence and the End of the Human Era. Well, you know, I think on an individual basis, there are still many folks out there who, for example, say, I'm not going to get a smartphone. I've talked to people like that. I will not get a smartphone. I don't want to be tracked. I don't want to be monitored. I'm going to stick to my old phone here, and that's that. But I don't know anywhere where I've read of this larger conversation, and I want you to comment on the fact that Gates and Hawking and Musk have now gotten into this conversation, but only in a very general way. I don't. Where do you go to find anybody who said, here's where we ought to draw the line?
You know, there's nobody. This is happening so fast. I mean, I think that there's a zeitgeist going on right now that says AI and automation and computers might be going too fast. There are people that are, as you said, there are people that are reacting. There's a little bit of computer backlash going on right now. And there's going to be more as we see AI and automation take jobs. But there's nobody, really, who's saying, here's where we should draw the line. These are the values we want to keep. We don't want to become totally computerized. And I think people are hungry for that. People are looking for that. Right now, there's a growing sense that if we continue down this path, we will share the planet with machines that are extremely smart. The people I talk to who are making AI talk, you know, theoretically about machines that aren't just as intelligent as humans, but are thousands or even millions of times more intelligent in a general sense. So they can solve problems faster. So they can manipulate the internet faster. They can manipulate matter faster than we can. Stephen Hawking frightened even me when he said, we have to anticipate that there'll be a time when machines are able to outmanipulate our politicians and create weapons that we can't even understand. That's the part that got me. One of the things that super smart, super intelligent AI will be used for is to develop more advanced weapons. And so Hawking anticipates a time when they'll develop weapons that we can't understand. Now, you know, Stephen Hawking was the first to kind of raise his voice recently, and then Elon Musk came out and said, we're summoning the demon, and the development of advanced AI is our greatest existential risk. Then Bill Gates came out, and there's no more, you know, technologically savvy guy than Bill Gates, came out and said he didn't understand why more people weren't aware of the problem and concerned about it. And finally, Steve Wozniak, who co-founded Apple, came out and said the future looks grim because of advanced AI. So there's a growing sense that in our own lives, we need to make a little firewall about what part of ourselves we want to be digitized. And there's also a sense that down the road, we're going to struggle with machines that are more intelligent than we are.
Well, and I'd like you to touch on that for a moment, because when you talk about machine learning, you do mean machines who are doing their own thinking, who become, as I think you've quoted it in the book, self-aware, which we thought until now only humans had that trait. Beyond the weapons systems you mentioned, give us some other examples, whether it's the power grid, trains, airlines, transportation system, an asteroid headed for planet Earth. What could go wrong here? How bad does it get?
How bad does it get? Well, don't start any long novels. How bad does it get? Well, let's start back at human-level intelligence in a machine. When I polled AI makers, I refer to polls in my book, Our Final Invention, but I polled some AI makers, and I asked them, when do you think we'll be able to create human-level intelligence in a machine? The close date was about 2029, and that's Ray Kurzweil's date. He thinks we'll have virtual brains at the price of a computer by 2029. The outside date that I got was about 2100. About 3% of the people I polled said never, meaning that creating human-level intelligence in a machine was too difficult an engineering problem. A lot of people said around 2045. But then somebody who reviewed my book for The New Yorker, Gary Marcus, said, you know, in 100 years, it won't matter if it took 10 years from now or 50 years from now. What will matter is what happens after. Will we have been prepared? Now, when we think of artificial general intelligence or human-level intelligence in a machine as a milestone, then we have to accept that smarter than human intelligence is possible, or probably possible, because we don't anticipate that once we achieve that milestone, the development will stop. And also, at that point, we'll be able to create machines that have an awareness of their own programming, an awareness of their environment, and will be able to improve their own ability to manipulate objects and be intelligent in that environment, to achieve goals in that environment. And that's where we get self-aware, self-improving machines. Now, we think of computers as being garbage in, garbage out, but the theorists I spoke with that I've cited extensively in my book propose that machines that are smart or smarter than we are won't be benign. In fact, they'll develop basic drives. So you ask, how bad can it get? Well, this is sort of where we get to the how bad can it get territory. Steve Amahundro is an AI maker and theorist, and he applied rational agent economic theory to think about the really important question, how will superintelligent machines behave? You know, he's asking the question, he's saying, shouldn't we create a science for understanding superintelligent machines before we create them? And then how do you go about creating that science if you're not smarter than them yourselves? How do you understand something smarter than you? So he applied rational agent economic theory to this problem. And to be brief, rational agent economic theory was dreamed up by economists to try to anticipate markets. And the idea is intelligent agents will behave rationally, that human buyers will behave rationally, that they'll always buy to satisfy their goals and preferences, which are called, in economic terms, the utility function. Well, it didn't work for humans. We're really capricious. We buy things, you know, willy-nilly. The things we buy don't make any sense. But the same theory should apply to rational machines, logical machines, logic-based machines. So when Amahundro applied that to logic-based machines, he came up with basic drives that he thinks they'll develop. And he's got a lot of really good research to back it up. They'll be self-protective. They won't want to be unplugged, because to be unplugged or to shut off would be the worst thing that could happen to their goals. These are goal-driven, goal-based machines. They'll be creative. They'll look for ways to better achieve their goals. They'll want resources, because they'll need resources to achieve their goals, and they'll want to make sure the resources don't go away. So they'll be looking into the future of the resources they need to make sure they've got enough to achieve their goals. And they'll be efficient with these resources. So these basic drives, Amahundro argues, are an emergent property of creating self-aware, self-improving machines. Now, the problem is, for whatever goal the machine pursues, it will come in conflict with us about resources. Unless we can program in some kind of friendliness into a machine, And that turns out to be extremely hard.
And there are a number of people, I guess, who you talked with, or at least you mentioned it in your book, that we still must work on this idea of friendly artificial intelligence, the friendly robot as opposed to the enemy robot, to put it in movie terms.
Yeah, well, it seems basic. You know, Stephen Hawking said, facing this future of giant promise and giant peril, you'd think that the intelligent people would be looking for ways to make it safe, right? Well, the answer is wrong. There's no one's really looking into safety. Nobody at a high level in any of the companies that are producing AI is really battened down and looking at ethical issues. There are some organizations. I'd like to mention a couple. One is it's called MIRI, the Machine Intelligence Research Institute, that's doing important work about creating friendly AI. The Future of Humanity Institute at Oxford is doing the same thing. A new organization at MIT is trying to make AI development more safe, and it's called the Future of Life Institute. So there are some people looking into it now, but these are think tanks. They're not corporations. They don't have Google's war chest of $300 billion. They don't have the NSA's black budget of $50 billion. So what they're doing is, I think, hopeful, but also kind of quixotic.
I'm Bob Kustra, host of Reader's Corner. Today I'm speaking with James Barrett about his book, Our Final Invention, which focuses on the perils of developing advanced artificial intelligence. What do we know about the role that government is playing? And I know you quoted someone earlier as saying that these machines are going to outsmart governments. But in the meantime, it seems as though either in the United Nations or in some international body or even the United States government, there ought to be a focus on this. Is there?
Nope. you'd think. Yeah. I think that's what people like me are trying to do. They're trying to raise awareness so that this becomes an issue that government pays attention to. You know, Rachel Carson wrote a book in 1963 called Silent Spring.
Right.
And it was about DDT and the havoc that DDT created in the environment, specifically on birds. You know, the environmental movement really didn't have much traction until she wrote that book. And then not just that issue, but a bunch of issues started to get play. Al Gore created An Inconvenient Truth, this film that really put global warming and climate change on the front lines. Where we are right now with AI risk is probably where climate change was in the 60s. You know, it's just starting to percolate as an issue for some people. I did get a call from Congressman Brad Sherman from California, who wanted to talk about AI risk. He's been thinking about it for a long time, and we haven't come up with any way to work together. But there is a congressman, I'm happy to say, Brad Sherman, who's looking at AI with ethics in mind. So, you know, your question is there an IAEA, like the International Atomic Energy Association, for AI? And the answer
exactly.
is no.
Yeah.
No.
Sometimes it's the most unlikely of folks who find themselves in these positions where they can influence thinking along these lines. Your book is certainly doing that. But in your book, you mention a guy that I thought was just fascinating, Yudkowsky.
Yeah, Eliezer Yudkowsky.
Tell us about him. And I mean, he is really a pretty unusual guy out there in the real world.
He sure is. He's a, you know, if AI risk theory had a founding father, it would be Eliezer Yudkowsky. He's a polymath. He's good at everything, mathematics, logic, who lives in California and started thinking about this issue around the year 2000. And he started the first organization that later became MIRI, the Machine Intelligence Research Institute. He's kind of a reclusive guy, but he's a very deep thinker, and he laid some of the groundwork for most of the thought that's gone into AI risk. And I interviewed him for my book, and before I interviewed him, I read a lot of his papers, and he's written quite widely. Unfortunately, it's a very small audience that pays attention to AI risk. So he's still He's a celebrity he's a celebrity in my world, but I hope he's a celebrity in the real world in time. You know, if we navigate this future safely with AI, he'll be one of the people we'll have to thank. Mm-hmm.
You know, you mentioned Google and Ray Kurzweil earlier. He wrote a book in 2005 that the singularity is near. It's certainly a more optimistic view of artificial intelligence than some of the warning signals you're posting in your book. Tell us a little bit about where that book is in mainstream thinking in the computer business, so to speak.
Well, you know, Ray Kurzweil was a huge inspiration for me when I read his book that preceded that called The Age of Spiritual Machines. I found it to be a real revelation because he really quantified the progress that we're making with AI and where it was headed. And he did it in a very logical way. And he's got a long track record of being technologically very savvy. He's been called the Thomas Edison of our time. He's a brilliant inventor. I fault him on being too optimistic about the AI-influenced future. He paints a very rosy picture of this rapturous period ahead called the singularity. And in the singularity, what's supposed to happen is this confluence of advancing technologies, including AI, will help rid us of disease, will help us live longer, maybe indefinitely, will solve all our problems like famine, will introduce us to technologies we haven't yet really made much headway with, like nanotechnology. So in his future, and in the future of Peter Diamandis, with whom he collaborates frequently, it's all good news. I was interested in the more sober assessment of the technological future. And I've interviewed Ray Kurzweil twice, and his opinion is there's always an irreducible peril to new technology, that new technologies are always disruptive, and there's always an unknown factor, and they could always be dangerous. And my response to that is, yes, that's true, but there are very few technologies that are as sensitive as AI. The analogy I always bring up is nuclear fission, because I think AI development is tracking nuclear fission's development pretty closely. Nuclear fission, to remind your listeners, is the science that creates nuclear energy power plants and also creates nuclear weapons, atom bombs. In the 1920s and 30s, nuclear fission was thought of as a way to split the atom and get free energy. And then this period of utopia would follow, which is very much like Kurzweil's singularity. But what happened was fission was quickly weaponized, and we, the public, learned about it at Hiroshima. And then beyond that, we as a civilization, as a species, held a gun to our heads for 50 years with the nuclear arms race, with mad, mutually assured destruction. That's what kept the peace. So the maintenance plan for fission was zero. There was no maintenance plan. There was a reactive plan, and we watched it escalate into this global brinkmanship that almost brought us to annihilation a few times. Unfortunately, AI is more sensitive than fission, because AI is the invention that creates inventions. Intelligence is the superpower that we humans have. Once we're sharing the planet with something more intelligent than we are, we're not going to be able to control what it's developing. And we already know that AI is being weaponized. It's being weaponized in battlefield robots and drones. And again, we have no long-term maintenance plan.
Well, James, it's time for us to move on, but I'm just delighted you were willing to come on and talk about the book. This is a subject that shouldn't be left to a 30-minute conversation. Get out there and get the book, Our Final Invention, Artificial Intelligence and the End of the Human Era, by James Barrett. James, thank you so much for joining us today at Reader's Corner.
Bob, thank you so much for having me. The pleasure was mine.
I hope you enjoyed this encore edition of our interview with James Barrett. Next week, Charles Fountain, author of The Betrayal, the 1919 World Series, and The Birth of Modern Baseball. Reader's Corner is presented by Boise State Public Radio. The engineer for today's show is Eric Jones. Research by Deborah Palmer. Our producer is Janelle Brown. I'm Bob Kustra. Please join me next week as we talk to today's leading writers about the ideas and issues that help shape our world at Reader's Corner. You'll find links to previous shows, including last week's interview with National Book Award winner Timothy Egan, on our website. That's BoiseStatePublicRadio.org.